So some of you have now gotten confirming notes that I've got a public key and that it appears to be good. Please check whether you can log in. If you have not gotten a confirming note, then either I did not get a key from you, or the key I got was in some fashion malformed. I have a suspicion that many of you, contrary to instructions, tried to generate your keys using PuttyGen. And PuttyGen generates SSH version 1 keys. Those are not useful. So there may be an option to PuttyGen to do version 2 keys or use SSH keygen. I don't use PuttyGen, so I don't know. But
I tried PuttyGen, didn't get anything good with it. I did SSH keygen, and you can open up the SSH key with PuttyGen and then import it to PuttyGen.
Okay. So apparently you can use SSH keygen. And having generated a key that way, you can import it into PuTTY. Why PuttyGen doesn't do version 2 keys, I don't know. But the issue is there was a format change, and the older keys actually can't be added to the authorization file in the new version of SSH. And there's probably a conversion process, but I don't know what it is. Also, the other common problem was people supplied RSA keys, no DSA keys. I actually said that in class. If you haven't gotten notes from me, you had one of those problems or the other. The SLAB assignment went out on the email list this morning officially. I debated due dates. I hated to do it either just before or just after the break. I was inclined to do it just before to get it over with. But I knew you were traveling. And also, even though I sort of handed out the header file last week, right, it's a little tight for time if we make it due on the 17th, which would be the last day before the break. A bunch of you probably want to go home after your last class. Therefore, I went ahead and I made it due the Monday after the break. But of course, here this is catch 22, right, because now people will be working over the break, which I didn't really want to do. My suggestion is, if you've been working on it in a timely fashion, you shouldn't have any trouble getting it done before the break. But I wanted to allow, in case there should be questions, that there would be some time in the schedule to recover. I would say try to get it done. I also announced that there will be a midterm on the 27th, which is the day, first day of classes after the break. I may need to revise that. Let me just double check that that's going to work. So midterm on the 27th. And again, I would have done that the Wednesday before break, but we had somebody traveling. Okay, so I wanted to go through some of these examples that I've been deferring for lack of PowerPoint. We talked about semaphores, and the standard semaphore is just grabbed or not grabbed, right? And the reason the values are described in the handouts as 0 and 1 is leading into the counting semaphores, okay? So, because in the counting semaphores, you're going to go to more values than 0 or 1, so that's why it doesn't start with true and false. But if it was just a basic semaphore, it could be true and false. So, the key properties of a semaphore, again, this is leading into the multi-value one, that if the count is greater than 0, then you have that number of processes waiting. And if the, that's the number of processes that can proceed. And if the count is negative, that means you've had enough that people are starting to block. So the reason you have a counting semaphore is you may have a situation where you have, 10, 15 processes trying to do something. For some reason, you only want to allow 5 at a time. Either because you have a limit on the size of a buffer, or you have a limit on the number of threads that are available to do the computation, or something of this sort. So The point here is to talk about that the counting semaphore action can be implemented in terms of the binary semaphore. And the basic trick is that you use the binary semaphore to wrap the counter. So anytime you access the counter or you manipulate the counter, you grab a binary semaphore first.
When you say grab, you mean change the value?
What do you mean change the value?
Like flip it from 1 to 0.
Flip what?
Flip the binary.
No, you call the wait or the signal routine, which were described on the previous slides. Okay. All right. So producer-consumer problem basically is you have a bounded buffer, and you're going to put data in the buffer, and somebody else is going to read it out. And you have several producers and several consumers, but you have a bounded supply of buffer. So the design strategy for this is say, look, take a simple problem. Start with the scenario where the buffer is not bounded. And then what you'll do is that the producer will simply wait to append, right? That's the mutex. They'll go ahead and put whatever it is they want to do, and then they'll release. And by the way, notice there's a bad line break here. So if it looks a little confusing, it's because it wrapped in a funny way. And then, so the problem is that the receiver, there are two mutexes here, right? One is authority to add. That's the one that's labeled mutex here. But the other is that the receiver has to know when there's something to do, right? So if the buffer is empty, the receiver has to lock. Okay, and this signal full is telling the receiver that there's something to do. The receiver, meanwhile, or the consumer, meanwhile, says, well, wait until there's something to do, and then if there's something to do, grab a lock on the buffer, strip a message off, process, release the lock, and process it. Okay, and then when I've got all the messages, when I run out of messages, go back to waiting until there's more to do. Okay, so full here is actually misnamed. Maybe full should be named non-empty. Okay, so the bounded buffer version says, well, okay, now what do I do if I fix storage? And the rule is that the consumer can pull anything out of the buffer whenever they want, as long as there's something there. But the producer is going to get stuck if the buffer becomes full, right? So there's a trick to this, and the trick is basically to leave yourself a little bit of spare room. So one way to think about this is the producer is producing full cells and the consumer is producing empty cells. Right? Because when I take something out of the buffer, that leaves a cell that's empty. So, same basic picture, except that now we're going to use a counting semaphore. The buffer is initially empty, and the buffer is assumed to have size n. And so, up at the top, you see that this counting semaphore is initialized to n. So we have n empty slots. Okay, and the append operation is going to update the empty count. Reader's writer's problem is a similar kind of a problem. That you can have several readers, they can all read at the same time, but writers have to write exclusively. So the idea is I'm going to stick things into the buffer in some order, but reads are allowed to proceed in parallel. And again, we have a wrapping problem on the slide. And the idea here is essentially that each reader is going to get a unique message, but they're not going to get them in any particular serialized order. So the difference between this and the previous scenario is in the previous scenario, we basically have one reader and one writer and one reader, one producer, one consumer, and we have a buffer. Right? In this scenario, we have multiple readers who are stripping messages off. So this is the scenario where I'm sending messages to some kind of a multi-threaded service, and the threads on the server side are going to strip off messages and process them, and so on, define order.
Okay.
So we did conditions of deadlock. The reason I'm bringing this back up is I want to show this resource allocation graph idea. So the pattern that you need is this kind of circular dependency, right? So okay, I didn't cover this second bullet here. So the conditions of, let me back up. So these conditions, if all three of these conditions hold, there's no real way to resolve the deadlock, short of killing somebody, which is a form of preemption. But basically, if the situation is you've got to hold and wait, and you have an exclusivity on a resource, and nobody is willing to yield to the other, and then you get a circular dependency, there's just nothing you can do, right? Because you've said, well, all the conditions that might let me get out of this have been ruled out. Right? Because either somebody's got to back off, or somebody's got to quit holding, or I have to somehow get rid of the mutual exclusion. So if you take these four conditions together and you don't deadlock, it means you got lucky. If you have these four conditions simultaneously in the system, you can deadlock. So one way to figure out what's going on if you're trying to resolve a deadlock problem is to use what's called a resource allocation graph. And so the idea is the squares are resources and the circles are processes, and inside the each square is a resource type, and inside the square, the little dots, little square dots represent instances of that resource. So for example, there are multiple pages in the system. The little white dots are one per individual page, etc. And when a process makes a request on a resource, it's requesting, the assumption here in the model is, I'm requesting a resource of a particular type, and I will accept any instance of that type. Now, there are some resources where there's only one instance. But for example, if I need an empty page, I don't really care what empty page I get most of the time. Turns out there's some flaws in hardware. Occasionally I do care, but the right way to think about that is I have multiple classes of pages that are different resource classes. So when I request a resource, that's when the blue arrow goes in. Okay, and when the resource is actually granted, what we're going to do is we're going to replace the blue arrow with a white arrow that's going from the instance that was allocated back to the process that owns it. Okay. And the way you know you've got a deadlock is you notice a loop in the graph. There's a cycle in the graph, you have a deadlock. What's important about this diagram is that some of the arrows in the cycle are blue. Right. These are commitments that have been requested but not yet been made. So it is a possible resolution here to say, well, I'm just not going to make that commitment. The problem is this requires cycle detection, and there are no efficient algorithms for cycle detection. Let me explain what I mean here by efficient. We talk in the algorithms class, when we talk about complexity of algorithms, right, that the bad algorithms are the ones that are somehow NP-complete. And as long as your algorithm runs in polynomial time, in some way this is better. Now, this is absurd. It's well known that there are NP-complete algorithms that in practice run faster than polynomial algorithms. And even polynomial time algorithms are way too slow for operating systems. I mean, the polynomial we want is one. We want algorithms that run in some linear time in the number of objects involved. And not only that, we want that number to be constant. We want that number to be a small constant. Because we want, there are two things we're trying to control. We're trying to control what's the absolute latency, duration of the system call, but also we're trying to restrict the variance. Okay? And the more objects we put in the picture, the more places we're going to miss a cache, We're going to have some other delay in the system. We're going to have some object that's not in memory. Each of these things makes the result less predictable. And a lot of what we want is predictability. That's not even not in real-time systems. When we start talking about real-time systems, that's not a nice to have. It's an absolute requirement that the system be designed that way. Because if it's not, we don't know what the times of the calls are. If we don't know what the times of the calls are, any story about doing any kind of a hard real-time schedule is just stupid. Okay. So by small constant, we're looking for something where, you know, I know I'm going to hit at most 20 objects. And if I can't break the operation up and use that small, I need to rethink the interface. Unix, by the way, violates this state. Badly. Now, 20 is not a magic number. Maybe the magic number is 40, but there should be a bound. As a practical matter, things that are log of the size of your memory are small enough. Right, so that's enough to do lookups. Right, if you could do some kind of a tree structure that says, even if I had a tree that holds every page in my system, right, well, how many pages could that be? Well, I got a 32-bit address space, got about roughly a 4 kilobyte page size on those new machines, so we're talking 2 to 20 pages. Even if I put that in a binary tree, maximum traversal of the tree is going to be 20 steps. Right, we're still within the kind of limit we're talking. And if I do a hash table, I can do better than that. So the problem is that the algorithms that we know for cycle detection are a lot more expensive than that. And so while it's possible to do deadlock avoidance, my sense as a designer is that it's the wrong strategy. The right thing to do is engineer it out. Okay. So the deal is that when this blue arrow comes in and you have a cycle, so I said you have a deadlock. That's not precisely true. You only have a deadlock if you can't actually satisfy the request. So if I ask for a page, and there's an available page, and you can give it to me, we don't have a deadlock yet. It's got to be a request that cannot be immediately satisfied. So in the case where the orange boxes have only one resource and you get a loop, you're done. There's a deadlock if it's dependent on that orange box. Right? But if there's pages and you can allocate one, you may not have a deadlock yet. Okay, so what do you do about it? Well, I strongly think this is the right strategy. I'll talk about how to do this a little later. Deadlock avoidance. Do not run PowerPoint. Cool. Okay, so this is the one I talked about where you say, hey, I'm an optimist, right? I'll just, you know, when somebody asks me a question, the answer is yes, right? And then when it turns out the answer was no, go back and apologize and then kill them. Because I'm going to have to get that resource freed up. And the only way to do that, think about what happens from the application perspective. The application wouldn't have asked for this resource if it did not functionally require the resource. Well, if the application does functionally require the resource and we're going to go take it away, what we're saying is this application is not going to work. And there's no point running it further at that point. I mean, you could do some kind of a protocol where you've asked the application. So, for example, in a movie player, right? The movie player might be willing to slow down the rate at which it produces frames, and by doing that, it might lower the load that it presents in the system. So there are situations where you can negotiate load. People are very fond of this idea. What happens when you negotiate load is you introduce communication between multiple processes. Sometimes that's not what you want. Right? The foundation of security is not letting processes communicate and then restricting the ways in which they communicate. So the position for security is start with no communication and then tremblingly and fearfully add communication one small piece at a time and hope that you don't step over a cliff somewhere. Well, when you do a negotiated real-time scheduler, what happens is any process in the real-time class can now send messages to any other process in the real-time class. How? By altering their schedule requirements, which induces the real-time scheduler to communicate with the other guy on their behalf. Processes that often can also communicate through the paging system. I increase my load. System says, oh, chat needs more pages. Who can I take them from? You haven't run for a while, so we take your pages. And now you go and test to see if your pages are present by measuring the time it takes to satisfy an access. Guess what? We've just communicated information. Both of these are forms of covert channels. Actually, technically, there's some problem with the term covert channel. The signaling through the scheduler, I believe, is an overt channel. There were explicit legal communication paths at every step. It's just that we exploited them in an unintended way. But in the paging case, there actually was no explicit communication path. The path of communication was by virtue of our sharing the memory resource, even though we weren't supposed to be able to talk to each other directly.
Well, what information
anything it wants to tell you. Right? The presence or absence of a page is a bit. Right? That's a 0 or a 1 with some probability of error because there's some fuzziness in the communication. But that fuzziness can be overcome by error correction. So I can tell you anything I want. If I'm on the inside and I'm in a position to see sensitive information, I can transmit. The only question is how fast. And we don't know how to close all such channels, in principle. In fact, in principle, it may not be possible. Well, let me be careful. It is possible if we're willing to do purely deterministic computation. The cost of purely deterministic computation is a dramatic reduction in the utilization of the machine. So that's a cost we're usually not willing to pay. Among other things, we have to give up concurrency. All right. Okay. So, I've actually already done all of this, I think. Good. Eliminating mutual exclusion is kind of hard because the only way you could really do that is by saying, well, I need a resource, but I'm not going to tell anybody, I'm just going to use it optimistically, right? This is called trading a deadlock for a bug is not a good solution. Hold and wait, actually, it turns out you can get rid of. And the way you get rid of it is this strategy of saying, well, if I would wait, I will simply back out and I will release everything I've grabbed. But the cost of that is, in order to implement that, I have to accept a certain school of design for my system. And that school of design may or may not fit the application you're trying to do. And let me point out, this issue can arise at multiple levels. So, in fact, we could get this issue out of the kernel entirely by going to that microkernel atomic style design. But that doesn't eliminate deadlock in the system, right? It's still possible at application level to build shared memory scenarios and the applications can have this problem, right? So this sort of problem can arise at every level of abstraction where concurrency exists. The reason you care about getting it out of the kernel, so it's kind of like being a little bit non-deterministic. You can't be a little bit non-deterministic, and you can't be a little bit pregnant, and you can't be a little bit deadlocked. Right? Whatever level of abstraction you introduce deadlock at, everything above that is victimized. Right? And nothing above it can alter that. Whatever level you introduce non-determinism at, right, you can't rebuild it above that layer. Now, strictly speaking, that second statement is not true. I mean, in fact, at the level of what happens at the quantum physics, what's going on inside a transistor, inside a computer, right, is in fact a non-deterministic analog process that happens with enough statistical assurance that we're able to do deterministic digital behavior out of it. But that's a statistical aggregation effect, and it's not usually relevant to the kinds of things that we do in operating systems. So, obviously you'd like to avoid deadlock at the bottom of the system, and then you'll work your way up. Okay. Good. One thing you could do is you could say, this last bullet is kind of interesting, is you could say, look, suppose I were to present all of the resources I need, right? I'm going to do it all as one request. I'll give you a list, and I get them all, or I don't get them, any of them. And if I need to change my contract, the protocol is, step one is I give up all the resources I've got, and step two is I give you a new list. Now, in fact, we could merge those into a single operation. That would be enough. That would get us out of this deadlock problem. However, the pragmatic problem with this is, very often, I need to pin down one resource in order to find out the second resource that I need. Why? Because there are data dependencies between the objects. For example, I go to reference through a file descriptor. And in a multi-threaded kernel, I have multiple threads that can enter the kernel at the same time. Let's assume now that I do have multiple CPUs. So now I have to deal with the fact I can get multiple threads that enter the kernel, and they're really entering the kernel at the same time. One of them is accessing a file descriptor entry in the table, and the other one's closing that file. So now we have a race. And the way we have to resolve this race is we're going to have to grab a lock. After we grab that lock, right, that's a resource allocation. Now one of them is doing a read operation, and now that it has the lock, only now that it has the lock is it safe for it to examine that kernel data structure to find out what's the target object. And then in order to perform the read on the target object, because we have a concurrent system, now it has to do a lock on the target object. So you can see there's a sequential dependency for grabbing resources, and this story that I'll release them all and re-request them is kind of a dicey story. No, the thing that the lock protects is the resource. General rule. All right. Well, suppose we say we won't forget. So we could say, look, when you request a resource and you don't get it, we're going to release all the resources you've got. This is actually the atomic style. In fact, the difference is that in the atomic style, it's explicit in the code, and the proposal that's being done here is done implicitly. Okay. And for some resources, this is going to be problematic, because if you're in the middle of a print job, or you're in the middle of writing to a tape, or and I take the tape away and somebody else writes, what we get is scrambled eggs in the tape. The good news is that in practice, those kinds of counterexamples are almost always leaf resources. They're almost always the last thing you grab. And it's exceptionally rare to need more than one of them at the same time. I mean, yeah, we can imagine a hypothetical program that would copy stuff from one tape drive to another. But it's a contrived example. It's not a case you really want to worry about very much. Now, you could impose a total ordering on resource types. Why does a total ordering help?
So if there's only like one path to an object, and someone's already traversing that path, you won't be able to like, get ahead.
Not one path to get to an object. You're on the right track, good.
If you're going where I think you're going, you can prevent cycles in the graph. By having everything point only downstream?
You can't prevent cycles in the graph, because at some point you are going to get into a situation where you and I each need resources that the other holds. What we can do is detect cycles in the graph. So if the rule is allocate all of your pages first, right? Then allocate, probably have it backwards, right? In practice, it's probably, you know, grab process resources first, then grab pages. Then grab whatever the next thing is. And if everybody does them all in the same order, then it will turn out that the cycles become pretty easy to detect. And if you release them in the opposite order, it also turns out there's some deadlocks you can get into from disagreements about release order. Go through the semaphore example where there are multiple semaphores and look at what happens if you alter the order in which the semaphores are released. What you'll discover is things get dicey very quickly. I strongly encourage you to do this exercise. But, so the rule is, I have a window of time and I have to grab all my pages, and if I get past that window and I need another page, if I've allocated some other resource in the middle, I'm not allowed to ask for pages anymore. Because this imposes an order on the allocations, the cycles become pretty detectable. Okay, so the hypothetical story goes back to the oracle, right? It says, hey, look, make the process tell you everything it needs in advance. This doesn't seem to work very well. Mostly because we don't have an Oracle. If you do find an Oracle, don't mess around with Deadlock. Go to the stock market. All right. So the last thing is you need deadlock detection. And to do deadlock detection, and by the way, I want to point something out before I do this, right? So notice the multiplication of complexity. Right? We started with a deadlock problem, and we had an initial choice. Fix the design or live with the deadlock. And we said, well, we'll live with the deadlock. Now we're introducing another algorithm to recover from the bad design decision. This is how kernels get to millions of lines of code. What we're doing here is we're applying an ugly fix because we failed to apply the right fix earlier. So I would argue that if you discover that you have a kernel with a deadlock detection algorithm, the right thing to do is install a better kernel. Don't try to fix the deadlock detection algorithm. What this tells you is the designers were incompetent. Unfortunately, there is no shortage of incompetent designers in the world. All right, so what's the safe state? Well, the first thing is, we're talking here about a system-wide safe state, right? So the system as a whole is still in a safe state if somebody can make progress. And the intuition is, if somebody can make progress, then eventually they'll finish. And if they finish, they'll release resources, and then somebody else will get to make progress. So what we're trying to detect here is not the situation where some particular process is stuck. What we're really trying to detect here is a situation where the entire system as a whole is stuck. What happens with deadlocks is they cascade. You'll get a small deadlock, and then somebody else will come along and innocently ask for something, and now you have a slightly larger deadlock. Pretty soon, every process in the system can be deadlocked. It's surprisingly easy to do. Okay, so the assumption in the model is we know what resources P can still request. So we got a list, not here are all the things that I need right now, but here are all the things that I will at some point ask for. And I may not have asked for all of them. And you basically ask, is there some process such that, considering the resources you've already committed, you could still satisfy the hypothetical future requirements of this process? All right. If that's true, there's no global deadlock. There may be a local cycle, but that's not a deadlock yet, because we may free up the resources that are required. See, you see the intuition? We have some set of resources that are allocated. We have a set of processes. And there's at least one process where we can allocate everything it needs. So there's at least one process that still has a guarantee of progress. As long as there's one, we're not in a situation of deadlock. Notice this is a painful algorithm because we're actually going to have to iterate over all the processes. That's exactly the kind of expensive algorithm we don't want to run. All right. So then we get these two nice statements, right? We say, well, assuming we were to run that algorithm, we'd actually come out with this result that if the system is safe, we know there's no deadlock. If there's a deadlock, we know the system is unsafe. There is actually a middle position. So the unsafe state doesn't mean you have a deadlock. It means you might have a deadlock. Now you have to go check. Because there might not actually be a dependent cycle. The avoidance strategy is to conservatively say, well, I will never let myself enter an unsafe state. As long as I don't step over the line into an unsafe state, I'm still okay. There's an algorithm for doing this. The algorithm's coming up. So OK. So there's an algorithm that relies on the allocation graph. Basically, it says, look, what we're going to do is we're going to use the blue arrows and the white arrows to record requests versus allocations. And as we allocate, we're going to do some bookkeeping. And the algorithm is only going to allocate if allocating does not introduce a cycle. Now we have to do cycle detection. So just to give you the idea, right, the idea is P1 is going to request resource A. We're going to go ahead and allocate it. And now P2 is going to request resource B, but the dashed lines are possible future requests. And the problem is that if we were to grant that resource and then take into account the future requests, there's no guarantee of global progress. Because now it's possible that somebody can make a request that would really introduce a cycle. All right. So you have to do this on every resource request, which is part of why it's expensive. So there's an algorithm called the Banker's algorithm, and this one deals with the multiple instance problem. And it says, okay, what I'll do is I'll keep a vector of available resources. For every process, I'll keep a vector, so the entries in the vector, each entry corresponds to a resource type. So for each process, I'll keep a list of how many it might ask for, I'll keep a list of how many it's got, and I will keep the delta, mean, right? So mean is simply the difference between how many it's got and how many it's permitted to ask for. Nothing terribly magical here. And I'll have some data structures that will allow me to run this computation, and I'm going to go looking for a process such that it's not done, and the amount that it needs is less than the working resource I've got, or equal to the working resource I've got. Okay. And if I'm able to find such a process, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and actually allocate those resources. And having allocated the resources, I'm going to declare that this process is now done. I need to explain. What we're doing here is a thought experiment. We're not actually running the process here. We're doing a pass that says, if we were to allocate the resource, would the process finish? So when it says mark it finished, that means if we were to do this, it would finish, right? We're doing it, this is a detection algorithm. We're not actually allocating resources, although we could. Now that it's finished, so if there's no such process, then either all the process is finished or somebody's stuck. If all the process is finished, we're still good. If somebody's stuck, then you may be involved in a deadlock. Okay, so notice what's going on here is this work equals work plus allocation. So work is short for working set. It's how much I've got. The idea here is, well, if this process would finish, it will give up its allocation. And that's why we're adding that allocation back into the working set. So what's really happening is here, we're iterating over the process. We're finding somebody who could run. We assume they do run. And we assume that when they've run, they give up whatever they've got. And we're just going to keep turning the crank on that. And when we stop turning the crank, either somebody's stuck or we're good. But notice this is an n squared algorithm, right? Because we're going to have to do multiple passes over the process list to do this. And in fact, it's an n cubed algorithm because each time we look at a process, we have to do a vector log. Considerably larger than the small constant factor we were looking for. All right. Okay, so this is just emphasizing that there's a tentative allocation. So when a resource request comes in, there's a way to update all the tables so that you can then run the detection on it. And essentially what you do is you say, another trial bloat. Suppose, obviously if I don't have enough, we're done. If I have enough, suppose notionally I were to do this allocation. I'm going to do it provisionally. And now, under the assumption that I've done this allocation, I'm now going to run the cycle detection algorithm. And if the cycle detection algorithm says I'm still okay, deadlock detection algorithm. The deadlock detection algorithm says I'm still okay, then and only then I will allow this resource allocation to proceed. So that's how we're going to determine whether to allow each resource allocation to proceed. Right, and you can see this is expensive. Because remember, on each path through the kernel, we're going to do multiple passes of this. All right. So worked example, and the question is this a safe state? I think there actually was a year when I did not give a problem like this on a midterm. But I'm not sure. So you compute the mean set simply by taking the set difference, right? So we're subtracting allocation from max. And the sequence is, we have enough resource that we can go ahead and run P1. And if we go ahead and run P1, then it'll give up those two A's, and now we'll be at 5.32. And if we're at 5.32, then we have enough to run P3. And P3 will give up the 2.11. Now I'll be at 7.44 unless I've made an arithmetic error. Never trust my arithmetic when I'm standing on my feet, and challenge my arithmetic when I do it on paper. But you see, the idea here is we're going to provisionally run each process, and we're going to say if we were to run them in some order, would it be okay? One piece of good news here is because once I run a process, it exits. So this is not one of these situations where I'm going to need to backtrack, right? Because as long as I can get a process to go away, I'm winning. And I can either get it to go away or I can't. So I'm not going to backtrack, but I may have to do multiple iterations to find the next process to run. Sorry, I may have to do one iteration per attempt. And in each iteration, if a process exists that can run, I'll find that process. Okay, so in this case, we actually have a problem. Let's just see. Wait, is this? Oh, right. So this is the situation where P1 is asking for more resource. Right, so the changes are the ones that you see in red. And we'll run the algorithm again to detect if there's now a deadlock. We do not detect a deadlock because there still exists a self-sequence, a safe sequence, so we will allow the allocation. Okay. We're going to break momentarily, but I want to pause and make sure people get this. You sort of see the idea here? Do a couple of worked examples. You definitely want to work through this because you want to facilitate. Because this is the kind of thing where just dumb math errors will kill you. It's not a complicated problem, right? Unless you're complacent about it. Can't tell you, high school, how many points I lost for stupid arithmetic errors. Or for that matter, in college. Okay, questions about this strategy? So when do you want to use the Banker's algorithm? Well, if you have a system that's already hopelessly busted and you've got to do something to recover, this is better than doing nothing. And And you may not have the option to redesign the system. Right? There are parts of the POSIX API that would make it very hard to get rid of these kinds of requirements. All right, so well, what about if P4 now attempts to allocate? I'm actually going to skip this. So the banker's algorithm is actually used so that you never enter a deadlock state. The other option is to say, just check for error. Right? And that's what we're gearing up to here, is to detect when you have a problem. And so here's the rationale. Hey, if I have to do this really expensive algorithm, and I think deadlock is really rare, notice, if I'm deadlocked, right, my only solution is to kill somebody anyway. The only question is, am I going to kill them now or am I going to kill them a little later? And if it's rare enough, and if it's expensive enough to detect, maybe the answer is, look, you know, I'll let it detect you every minute. And we'll do it every resource allocation. Because I'm not going to get caught. All I'm going to do is delay the repair. And I'm delaying the repair on things that aren't making progress anyway. So what's the worst that will happen is I'll slow the system down a little bit for a little while.
Right.
And you can trade off how often you run it versus how expensive it is.
Okay.
Last comment on this and then I'll stop. Actually, let's see where we are.
We're very close to the end. In fact, we are at the end. But oh, lovely.
All right. So the model here is I'm going to abort processes, and there's a huge semantic problem with that, which I will come to next week. But here's the teaser question. Hidden assumption. The kernel has the authority to abort processes. It's not obvious that assumption should be right. It's certainly true in Windows and Linux, right? Your process lives and dies at the whim of the kernel. It's not clear that that's actually the right way to design systems. But certainly, if we did design a system that way, we can abort the processes. And we can back out all the resources. I mean, there's something short of aborting the process. You can leave the process running, but in a state that says, hey, this process is never going to make any more progress because we took its resources away because it was a bad boy. Which amounts to the same thing. All right?
And, okay.
In real systems, you don't do these things in isolation. There's a bunch of reasons to integrate them. Because they're expensive. So you have some lighter weight strategies that you use on resources that are really, really low likelihood to deadlock. And then you do fancier processing on the things that are likely to deadlock. So on modern systems, you have a large enough supply of pages. You have a large enough supply of swap space. If you manage to get to the point where you allocate all the pages you've got, finding the deadlock quickly is the least of our problems, because what the system is now doing is moving data in and out of the disk as fast as it will go, which is not very fast. Right. So, and furthermore, we're going to notice, hey, we're going in and out of the disk as fast as we can go. This might be because we have an overcommitment problem. Now's a good time to get deadlock detection. You also might notice the processes have not run for a long time and choose to run the detection algorithm then.
So there's a range of possibilities. So, good. Let me stop here, and we will resume on Monday. Please make sure I get your public keys.